I'm Steve Skinner, and this is KFFR Winter Park, community radio for the Fraser Valley and the headwaters of the Colorado River at 88.3 FM and streaming worldwide at kffr.org.
Good morning. I'm Stacy Stein, and we are joined on the phone with Dr. Michael Greger. He is a physician, New York Times best-selling author, and internationally recognized professional speaker on a number of important public health issues. Dr. Greger has lectured at the Conference on World Affairs, the National Institutes of Health, and the International Bird Flu Summit, among countless other symposia and institutions. Dr. Greger has testified before Congress and has appeared on shows like the Colbert Report and the Dr. Oz Show. He was invited as an expert witness in the defense of Oprah Winfrey at the infamous Meat Defamation Trial. And in 2017, he was honored with the American College of Lifestyle Medicine's Lifestyle Medicine Trailblazer Award. Dr. Greger's most recent scientific publications in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, Critical Reviews in Microbiology, Family and Community Health, and the International Journal of Food Safety, Nutrition, and Public Health explore the public health implications of industrialized animal agriculture. We have been airing Dr. Greger's Nutrition Facts segments from his website, nutritionfacts.org, over the past couple months here on the CoronaCast, and we are very excited to welcome him to the show. Good morning, Dr. Greger.
Good morning. I am so excited to be here.
We're thrilled to have you here, Dr. Greger, and we're going to have to encourage you to continue, as you do in your website videos, to talk as if we are, not as educated as some of the other people that you might make discussion with. So, make sure that you talk to us so we can understand.
I will do my best. Stop me if I say anything that's above the pay grade.
Okay. Your new publication is How Not to Die in a Pandemic. Can we start with that? How do we do that?
How to Survive a Pandemic. A little more positive title. Same basic concept, though. Where I cover everything there is to know currently as to how to protect ourselves and our families from the coronavirus, optimal restoring hand hygiene, surface disinfection, everything from masks to, how to make your own hand sanitizer. But really the best way to survive a pandemic is to prevent it in the first place. And so the bulk of my new book, which just came out yesterday, centers around tracing the origins of the COVID coronavirus and what we can do to prevent even greater infectious disease threats in the future.
Tell us about that.
Well, over the last few decades, hundreds of new pathogens have emerged at a rate unprecedented in human history. You say, wait a second, emerged from where? Mostly from animals. The AIDS virus is blamed on the butchering of primates and the bushmeat trade in Africa. Mad cow disease was because we turned cows into carnivores and cannibals. SARS and COVID-19. Have been traced back to the exotic wild animal trade. But our last pandemic, swine flu in 2009, arose not from some backwater wet market in Asia, but was largely made in the USA on pig operations in the United States. Thankfully, swine flu only killed about 500,000 people, but the next time, we might not be so lucky.
Dr. Greger, it seems like we know a lot about what causes these diseases. We've known for a long time climate change was happening, but there's some human condition that will not let us out of our comfort zone to actually take action.
That is an important insight. So, for example, I have been, I wrote a book on pandemic preparedness in 2006, shouting from the rooftops, as other public health professionals have done, about the next coming pandemic, yet people just were not ready to think about it. I mean, it's almost too terrible to imagine, so we just kind of put blinders on and try not to think about it. Now, of course, you can't help but think about it, but hopefully what the silver lining here is that this will finally kind of orient the countries of the world to really take seriously this concept of pandemic prevention. Now that in the age of global commercial airline travel, you know, viruses can escape our grasp in a matter of days. So we really need to prevent the emergence of these viruses in the first place. And if you look at the, if you look around the world, the countries best able to handle COVID-19, you know, countries like Taiwan and Singapore, South Korea, the reason that they have done such a better job than most other countries is because they were prepared because they recently suffered deadly coronavirus outbreaks. SARS and MERS, South Korea had a big MERS outbreak in 2015, and so they put these measures in place because they knew they were at risk. The citizens, you know, knew of the possibility, and so were very able to rapidly respond. And so now, and so look, that if that's what, you know, dozens of deaths or hundreds of deaths can do, is ready countries for pandemic preparedness. Well, hopefully, the potentially millions of deaths from COVID-19 will really orient us towards pandemic prevention, and that's really where I hope to contribute my expertise.
And Dr. Greger, we hear a lot about herd immunity and the immune system really being our best defense for this COVID-19. Can you maybe give people an introduction on some of the best foods that serve the immune system if people do want to start making those baby steps towards change?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. The only way to stop a pandemic is this concept of herd immunity, having a critical portion of the populace immune to the virus. An infection can only burn through a population if there are enough susceptible individuals for the viral sparks to jump from one person to the next. Immune individuals who can't get or transmit the virus act as fire breaks to slow the spread, or like control rods in a nuclear reactor to break the chains of transmission. Now, ideally, this is accomplished through mass vaccination. Vaccines are a way to fight fire with fire, using the virus to fight the virus by generating the benefits of infection, immunity, without the risks of infection, disease, and death. And so, you know, when one looks in one's community and sees, you know, very few cases, and indeed over the entire country, even when you throw in hotspots like New York City, on average, less than 5% of the U.S. population has been infected so far based on the limited testing we've done. And so and so people view that as a positive. They're like, oh, well, you know, it's, things aren't as bad. But actually, in terms of the end goal, in terms of stopping this virus, that means, oh, my God, we're in like inning two. You know, we're really early on. We really have to reach 60-70% of the population immune. And if we don't have a vaccine, the only way we get herd immunity is kind of the hard way, through mass infection, if not through mass vaccination. And so think about the devastation measured in lives and livelihoods that getting us up to 5% infection. I mean, if we have to go to 60 or 70% infection, you can see how long a process this may take. And unfortunately, you know, it's humbling to realize that historically, the average vaccine has taken more than a decade to develop, with an average failure rate 94%. So this is not something that you can turn around. Now, we do have more than 100 vaccine candidates now in the pipeline. We should expect that at least few are going to be safe and effective. But, I mean, it's just a fantasy to think that we're going to have a vaccine available for the general public anytime before the second half of next year at the earliest, if all things go right. And so that really places us in this kind of precarious situation. So what you mentioned, what can we do to protect ourselves, to lessen the likelihood that we're going to suffer a severe course? It's important to recognize that the vast majority of people, even elderly, frail, sick people, the vast majority survive this disease. And in many cases, it can be completely asymptomatic, meaning you get it and you don't even feel sick at all. And so how can we bolster our health to be able to best survive infection? And the way we do that, first of all, try not to get infected in the first place, but because we are all at risk, particularly as things open up, we really need to look at what are these underlying risk factors for COVID-19 severity and death: obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure, and type 2 diabetes. Now, those of you who've been listening to these Nutrition Facts videos know that all of these risk factors can be controlled or even reversed with a healthy enough plant-based diet and lifestyle. You know, even having, not even being obese, excess body fat alone. So having a BMI, a body mass index of 28 or more, which is like being 175 pounds at the average American height of 5'6", puts you at 6 times the odds of suffering a severe course with this disease. In the United States, the average BMI exceeds 29. So even those skinnier than the average American may have enough excess body fat to put one at risk. And this is because having excess body fat causes a greater level of systemic inflammation. There's fat actually covering the heart itself. There's something called hypoventilation syndrome. You just have so much excess body fat in the upper body that you can't breathe as well. And so, look, we should take this opportunity, those of us who aren't on the front lines, who aren't essential workers, who have been kind of sheltering in place, stuck at home. This is the time to take care of yourself. If you always wanted to, you know, do some kind of meditation practice or, clean up your diet or a regular exercise program, this is the time we should really take care of ourselves. And so then not only protect us against this infectious disease, but reduce our risk of chronic illness in the long run. So sufficient sleep, keeping active, reducing stress, staying connected, albeit remotely, to friends and family, eating a healthy diet. These are critical kind of common sense measures we can take to protect ourselves and our families.
Dr. Greger, when talking about eating a healthy diet, what is the most misunderstood food, would you say?
Oh my God, it's almost easier to answer. Is there any food that's not misunderstood? I mean, there's just so much craziness out there. Soy foods. You know, there's a lot of craziness on the internet about soy foods. In fact, so much so that the truth is actually the diametric opposite of what you tend to hear about soy food. So, for example, there's this concern that soy foods increase one's risk of breast cancer because they have these phytoestrogens, which have estrogenic effects, when indeed actually the opposite is true. We now have a half dozen studies looking at thousands of breast cancer survivors, and basically those that eat soy tend to have lower cancer recurrence rates, tend to live significantly longer, lower cancer mortality. And this is whether they're estrogen receptor positive or negative, whether they're on tamoxifen or not, whether they have these BRCA genes, these breast cancer genes or not. Soy foods are protective both in preventing breast cancer, extending survival once you already have breast cancer. So that's one of these examples where it's not just kind of misunderstood, but actually what's kind of out there in the ether on the internet is actually the opposite of what the actual science shows. And so that's just kind of a particularly egregious example of why a resource like nutritionfacts.org is so necessary, just because, you know, we know that diet is the number one predictor of health and longevity. So the Global Burden of Disease study, the largest study of disease risk factors ever done, which was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, found that the number one cause of death in these United States is our diet, bumping tobacco smoking to number two. Cigarettes only kill about 500,000 Americans every year. Our diet kills many more, also a leading cause of disability. So that's the most important decision we can make day to day, is what we put at the end of our fork. So that's why eating healthy is critically important.
And just in talking about soy, it seems like there are some really kind of more like whole foods soy products, like tofu and tempeh or edamame. But then there's also like a lot of soy that's in fake meat products. I'm wondering if there's that, like, the health benefit is a difference, like, with those two different preparations and ways that we're finding soy in the supermarket.
I'm so glad you brought up that point. Yeah, so You can take really healthy foods and turn them into unhealthy foods through processing. So, for example, you take a beet, right, a sugar beet, super healthy food, but then you refine it into sugar. Most actually cane sugar on the shelves actually doesn't come from sugar cane. Actually comes from beets these days. And you have a really unhealthy food. You take wheat berries, this whole grain wheat, and you process it, remove all the fiber, remove most of the nutrition. You're left with white flour and Wonder Bread, and so you turned a healthy food into an unhealthy food. And soybeans as well. So you take, soybeans, super healthy. You can get them in a can. You can get them fresh in edamame, those pods, those immature green soybeans, which is a great, healthy, delicious snack. Tempeh, you can see the individual soybeans in there. Now, tofu is kind of a mildly processed food. They remove about half the fiber, half the minerals. Now, soybeans are so incredibly healthy. You can remove half the nutrition, still have a really healthy food, but not as healthy as tempeh, miso, edamame, these whole soy foods. And then when you get to the isolated soy protein, which makes up most of these kind of meat alternative substitutes, then you're really stripping away so much of the nutrition. Now, you could certainly argue, look, it's better. Look, you remove 90% of the fiber, it still has some fiber. It's better than, you know, the actual meat. So it's better to eat a, you know, processed soy burger than it is to eat a regular beef burger. At least it has some fiber, doesn't have the saturated fat and the cholesterol and, the trans fats. Certainly even, you know, it'd be better to just, black bean burger or something where it actually has some whole foods in there. That would be superior.
And it doesn't have the fecal matter, of course. I wanted to ask you I want to ask you about supplements. You're talking about beets, for example, and, you know, I drive around the country, I hear these radio ads, especially on some of the more bizarre radio stations that talk about like a beet concentrate, because beet is this superfood, and I don't need to eat beets. I can eat my burger and still take my beet pills.
Yeah, so what they're talking about are these vegetable nitrates. The most concentrated source is actually dark green leafy vegetables. So arugula has more nitrates than anything. But high on the list are beets, beet greens, and all dark green leafy vegetables. Super important for cardiovascular health, improving blood flow, improving athletic performance. You know, they have these athletes doping with beet juice. Beetroot works just the same. Frozen spinach works just the same. And there's actually, I have videos on the website talking about, the timing. You're going to run a 5K, when exactly should you be eating that, drinking that beet smoothie or whatever, to maximize performance. There really is a remarkable difference that you can – it's not just like a split second on your time. People actually, can shave, minutes off of a 5K and actually feel as if they're exerting themselves less. You actually derive more energy out of each breath. You extract more energy from oxygen because of these nitrates. Really amazing things. Now, can you get those same benefits from a nitrate pill? You do these experiments, and that's how we actually proved it was the nitrates in these pills, because you can get similar benefits using these nitrate supplements. But we can't do it necessarily without the risk. The risk of these sodium nitrate supplements is that nitrates, when exposed to the stomach acid bath without accompanying antioxidants, can turn into nitrosamines, which are carcinogenic compounds. The nitrates in vegetables come prepackaged with antioxidants. And protect the nitrates from turning into these carcinogenic compounds. Now, look, if you took that nitrate pill with a salad, okay, then we're fine. Then we're back to protecting those nitrates. If you ate a piece of fruit with the nitrate pill, fine. But if just taking the nitrate pill divorced from a natural source of antioxidants could be a problem.
What about other supplements like, that you hear these like prostate boosters and fish oils and vitamins and minerals? What about some of those? Do you have a stand on any of that?
In a certain extent, it depends on who you are. So most healthy people should rely on the produce aisle to get their nutrients rather than the supplement aisle, with a few exceptions. Now, you know, if you're an alcoholic or if you're pregnant or, I mean, there's certain circumstances, or if you, you know, gastric bypass surgery, you don't absorb nutrients as well. There are certain circumstances where absolutely you want to be supplementing. But in general, fruits and vegetables are where we should get most of our nutrition, and whole plant foods in general, with two exceptions. There's two vitamins that are not made by plants. One's vitamin D, which is made by animals such as yourself when you walk outside. It's a sunshine vitamin, but institutionalized elderly, people who don't get adequate sunshine, may need to supplement their diet with vitamin D. I recommend those getting inadequate sunshine, 2,000 international units of vitamin D3 a day. That's something that I take because I'm stuck in front of my computer all day and don't get outside as much as I should. And the only other vitamin that's not made by plants is vitamin B12, not made by animals either, made by little microbes that blanket the earth. So we used to get B12, you know, drinking out of a mountain stream or well water or something, but now we chlorinate the water supply to kill off any bacteria. So we don't get a lot of B12 in our water anymore. Don't get a lot of cholera either. It's a good thing. It's a good thing we live in a nice sanitary world. But because we do, we need to get a regular, reliable source of vitamin B12. Our fellow great apes get all the B12 they need eating bugs, dirt, and feces. I prefer supplements. So 2,000 micrograms of what's called cyanocobalamin, which is the cheapest, most shelf-stable form of vitamin B12, once a week is all you need. Costs less than $5 a year, but critically important for anyone eating a healthy diet to ensure a regular, reliable source of vitamin B12.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Greger. He's a physician, New York Times bestselling author, and internationally recognized professional speaker on a number of important health issues. And his latest book, How to Survive a Pandemic, just came out yesterday. Dr. Greger, I've heard a little bit about CBD, the non-psychoactive compounds in marijuana, or I guess it's maybe hemp, something related to the marijuana plant, but not the stuff that gets you high, being supportive in preventing or curing a coronavirus infection. Are you familiar with this?
I am familiar with such claims, and you will hear that from people coincidentally selling CBD products. and unfortunately, there is zero data to support that. In fact, very little data to support CBD for any application. Now, you could argue, well, that's, those studies just haven't been done. So maybe it's helpful. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, until we have those studies, we can't say for sure. But until we do know, it may be a waste of money or even worse, particularly because the purity of such products cannot be guaranteed. And so I would hesitate to recommend anyone taking any kind of substance for purported medicinal benefits if we don't have the science to support it.
Do you have a stand on marijuana? Marijuana is legal here in Colorado. People are making tinctures out of it, oils out of it. They're putting it in their eyes. It's just like the radio station is parked right next to a dispensary, and there is just an endless stream of people going in and out of that place,
sure,
getting their THC and CBD.
Yeah, no. Colorado was certainly one of the leaders, and so that's where we get much of our data from in terms of legalization and the pros and cons. And so I actually have, I think, a 16-video series on marijuana on nutritionfacts.org. So anyone who wants a deep dive into what exactly the science shows, this was prompted by a report out of the Institute of Medicine, which is kind of the most prestigious medical body in the U.S., recently came out and reviewed the thousands of studies that have been done and looked at the pros and cons. I would encourage people to go through that video series and as I go condition by condition and say exactly what's good, what's bad. Kind of the overarching bottom line is that it is much less risky than critics condemn it for, and much less beneficial that advocates praise it for. And so the truth is kind of right in the middle. So for things that, you know, people unquestionably think it's beneficial for, like glaucoma, actually it doesn't help with glaucoma. But it does certainly help with some conditions, but it's not without risk, particularly for the developing brain. And so this is before brain maturation, which really happens quite late in the human species, by around age 25. One can have long-term cognition deficits starting marijuana too early in life. But after that, some of the things people are concerned about, like lung cancer and COPD, have not materialized. So it's not like tobacco. And so some things we thought were bad actually turned out not to be bad. Some benefits we thought were there actually turned out not to be there. If you're interested in any particular aspect, either pro or con, I would encourage people to go to that free video series. All my work is free at nutritionfacts.org. In fact, even all the proceeds I get from my books are all donated directly to charity. I just want everyone to have access to this life-changing, life-saving information.
And seeing that my emotional maturity stopped about 13 years old, we really, really enjoyed your piece on beans. And when you were talking about gas and, we were just rolling in the aisles out here, just cracking up. So you do appeal to even people with the emotional agility of a small soap dish. So appreciate that very much.
Well, you will appreciate, I have some videos coming up on the pandemic, actually starting then this month, running through July. And yes, I do have a coronavirus and farts episode just for you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Gregor, thanks so much for joining us today. Is there anything else you'd like to share with listeners?
Oh, I'm just so honored to be here. I just want to share the good news. So we have tremendous power over our health, destiny, and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a healthy enough plant-based diet and lifestyle. I encourage people to check out my work. All my contact information is on the website. You can reach out to me and just encourage everyone to stay safe and take care of themselves.
Dr. Gregor, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Great talking to you. Thanks, Doc.
Keep up the good work.
You too. Bye-bye. That was Dr. Michael Gregor, a physician, New York Times best-selling author, and internationally recognized professional speaker on a number of important public health issues. His newest book, How to Survive a Pandemic, just hit the shelves yesterday. And you can also find many health resources and videos on his website, nutritionfacts.org.